Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, the second round tipped off. We had some game ones to react to. Huge win for the New York Knicks. An upset win for the Minnesota Timberwolves with Anthony Edwards back. We talk about what we saw and what we're going to see moving forward. We then preview some series that are tipping off later tonight. What is Thunder Lakers going to look like? What will Cavs Pistons look like? What are the battlegrounds? Who can swing this series? We talk about it. And then we shift to the W side. We start our two-parter in terms of the season preview. First, we look at the potential contenders, the teams that played well last year, the teams that were in the playoffs last year. What are we excited about? What are we concerned about? We hit on the other teams on Friday. But jam-packed episode. We hope you have fun with us. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Excited to talk about basketball today. And you get to the nature of going from a fun first round, a weird first round, a tight first round, an extended first round, game sevens into game ones of the second round. And it's a new round. It's new matchups. It's new challenges, potentially familiar challenges for certain teams. But each series is different. And so I'm very excited to talk about basketball today.
Oh, yeah. We got some doozies on the docket today. A couple of previews heading a little bit later. But we had second round action tip off last night, Steve. We start in the Eastern Conference in what was the blowout of the night. The New York Knicks, a 137-98 victory over the Philadelphia 76ers, taking a 1-0 series lead in this one. The game was pretty much over by halftime. And if it wasn't over by halftime, it was certainly over by midway in the third quarter, at the very least. But Steve, we'll concede the floor to you. What were some of your major takeaways from this one? What stood out to you in this Knicks win?
I mean, it's a team effort. I think just to talk about it, when you go from round one to round two, there's different things that happen. And so there's an element of culture shock going from one matchup to the next. And especially with a tight window, you go from a long extended series, you got a quick turnaround, you got to start the next series. You're kind of making attempts, but you don't necessarily know. It's very how you know type feeling. And then you learn very quickly. You're going from a series where you had a very specific game plan that you evolved and won and thrived through. You had some focus points. You play a team that was, you know, maybe slower, or you could attack these mismatches. You had these automatic reads because you knew exactly what they're going to do. And now you face a different team. It does not automatically carry over what you did. You can find success and know, okay, we have this in our back pocket. So we saw that early for the Sixers with, okay, Joel Embiid, you can be timely. Get Karl Anthony Towns in foul trouble. Oh, look, it's Mitchell Robinson. Let's go hack him, Mitch. Let's do these things. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to find it. The number one thing here is the New York Knicks played a fantastic game of basketball. I think that's the biggest thing you have to say. Jalen Brunson found his rhythm early in that first quarter against Joel Embiid and drop. And that's one thing the Sixers are going to have to make an adjustment with. This is a little bit of a different series with Brunson as far as being able to get to his spots and attack in space and mix in lobs for Mitchell Robinson. You have the pop of Karl Anthony Towns. Embiid came higher at times. They went to show and recover at times, but there was never a real force to where Brunson didn't have it on the table. On top of that, the Knicks had their off-ball movement working. Now, early, the Sixers were physical. They were active. You know, the Knicks went to try to the flex action, where, you know, Brunson screened for someone in the corner. They were physical, switched that. They went to get action. They were physical, switched that. It's a sneaky way for the Knicks to kind of get some mismatches, but they didn't have to. Like, you go back to that second quarter. Karl Anthony Towns was in foul trouble. Starts the second quarter. We start getting back to the movement. They get that back on the table. Now we have a wave. And I think that's the biggest thing for Philadelphia. We have to disrupt the Knicks' rhythm, because you had Jalen Brunson doing what he did. You had Karl Anthony Towns feeling a level of comfort as far as I can contribute to the game. OG Anunoby has just decided I would like to continue to play basketball. And he also was able to attack Joel Embiid in the drop. You just had balance. Like, they were shooting 65% in each of the first two quarters. I think the second quarter, all their starters scored six or more points. And, like, that makes it really tough. So the number one thing for me is you salute the Knicks for their defensive effort, and you salute the Knicks for just understanding the assignment. It feels like they learned from the Hawks series, and they present something that the Sixers now have to deal with if they want to get back in the series.
Yeah, I think the wave portion was the biggest thing that I wanted to hit on when it came to this game. Like, I think both of us were threatening the game, but I got to a point where in the third quarter, it's like, oh, the Knicks just have counters for everything that the Sixers are trying here. Like, this is just kind of tough. Like, you see these blowout games during the regular season or even the playoffs, and you just kind of lean on, oh, this team hit 18 threes. That's just kind of what it is. The fact that the Knicks, starting with Jalen Brunson, as you mentioned, drop, cool. Drop the switch, cool. Show and recover, cool. Oh, you're being physical with the off-ball stuff. We can now get that back. All right, neat. You're dinging us a little bit with these Joel Embiid post-ups. We can now alter where we're sending our help from. Now you're not going to have a good time. They just found answers throughout that game from different people, and it was one of the more enjoyable experiences I've had with watching the Knicks this year. Like, this is the high-end version of the New York Knicks. I think this was the vision. Like, you saw Mikal Bridges shaking loose with pull-up twos and transition baskets and actually getting to the rim. You already mentioned, I've just been so high on this OG Anunoby experience throughout this entire game. But it is another salute again for me to Jalen Brunson for setting the tone and dinging all of these coverages. And then to the Philly side quickly. One, there is just a general level of concern I have with Joel Embiid just from a health perspective. Like, Mikal Bridges fighting over that screen. You get Embiid in the midsection. He's killed over him. It's like, ooh, I don't know how he's going to move. The very next possession, the Knicks put him in action and pick and roll to get downhill. I'm like, well, that's rude, but it's also kind of smart. And so I'm just like, what is that going to look like moving forward? And I'm sorry for the basic analysis here. You just kind of need more shot making from the guards in this matchup. Like, Tyrese Maxey got to the line quite a bit, or got to the line towards the end of the first quarter of that game, but didn't make his first field goal attempt until midway through the second quarter. VJ Edgecombe really wasn't able to shake loose in this one. That is, again, a testament to the different matchups that the Knicks can toss at him in that way and just to cast the perimeter defenders that they have. But if you can't get the Embiid wave, and they're mixed again where they're sending their doubles, and Embiid didn't have the shot-making going, if you don't have the drives and the pull-up shooting from Tyrese Maxey, and you don't have the mix of drives and pull-up shooting from VJ Edgecombe on top of that, you run out of answers quickly in addition to the Knicks having answers on the other end. So, like, it is a testament to the Knicks. It also just felt like a very loud signal of, this is what we cannot afford if we are the Philadelphia 76ers. We can't let the Knicks have all of this on the table. And there is just a level of productivity and comfort that we need to have offensively so we can keep the pressure on.
Well, I mean, I think if we're talking about Philadelphia, it's going to be an interesting dynamic to see what they pivot to offensively. And I think you had that first quarter, which, number one, Maxey played the first 12 minutes. Embiid played 11:53. Brunson also played the first 12 minutes. So that's a dynamic to, like, keep in the back of your brain. But in Philadelphia, the blend is important because of what Joel Embiid can do to elevate your offense in the half court, right? They have found his ability to either draw a double, draw fouls, or make timely baskets to just make defenses feel uncomfortable. And I think he's been really timely since he's come back, as far as you don't really feel great about this. The Knicks were able to kind of figure it out, but Cat gets in foul trouble. We're staying at home. They end up doubling. It just didn't feel great. He was just in rhythm. The problem is you have to max out the Embiid minutes at the start of the game to a degree, and you kind of pivot away a little bit from Maxey. And so from a coaching perspective, I get the idea of, well, I know Embiid's going to play this amount of time. Maxey will get back into the game quicker than Joel Embiid. I can tap the Maxey button a little bit in the first quarter, but if Embiid has it going, let's max that out, and then let's get back to Maxey. And so I'm intrigued to see, like, when Maxey came back in that second quarter, he was aggressive, he was decisive, he was attacking the drop. They went to really high pick and roll to give him space to kind of snake and attack and get downhill. So what does that look like in game two? And we saw in the Boston series in pockets where it didn't feel like Maxey was decisive, and then he understood exactly what Boston was doing and said, yep, I'm going to take these shots. Look back at the difference between game one and game two, where, okay, I get it now. So does he become a different pressure point? We saw, even in that first half or first quarter, there were actions they were running, you know, as far as trying to run two screens near half court to get Jalen Brunson involved and try and attack those pressure points. Now, to the Knicks' credit, I think you have to give a tip of the cap to Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns. If we spent weeks and weeks and months talking about their defense, they answered the bell when Philadelphia decided we're going to put you two in action together. And I think that's kind of another thing you got to give the Knicks credit for, is being able to mix their coverages against Tyrese Maxey. Like, against Boston, it was drop, help will come, you either get your shot, you turn the corner, or you have a read. Like, there was it got automatic for him to a degree. It was interesting that first play of the game, you go back to it, Tyrese Maxey in pick and roll, Cat's in a drop, Maxey penetrates, Cat just takes the switch. And so we have the element of, we are going drop, too late switch, we can come closer to the level, we can do different things. And I think it was the second half, they put them back in action. And Brunson was able to just kind of steal a pick and pop. It wasn't Maxey involved, but I think that's where they're going to have to poke at the Knicks. But I think that's where the Knicks' lesson from the Hawks series, as far as we had to mix different things up against CJ McCollum. We had to be a little bit more aggressive and find different ways to deal with it. That's where that they got the benefit of the doubt there.
Yeah. So a quick note and then a question I want to ask you based on something that you said a little bit earlier there. Five pick and rolls ran against Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns in action together. 0 points scored on those possessions for the Philadelphia 76ers. I don't know if it's going to be that every game, but certainly you take that if you're the Knicks, and ultimately just doing your job makes the Sixers have to work deeper into the clock and it makes it a little bit more difficult for them. The question I had for you, because I also had in my notes the first quarter stints from the Stars and then the Sixers ultimately starting with VJ, PG, and the bench in that second quarter. Do you think they tweak that at all? To where you may sprinkle in an early rest for Maxey or an early rest for Embiid to make sure at least one of those two in particular is on the floor at all times? Or do you feel like that would be kind of an overreaction to what game one was?
I mean, game flow dictates everything. So I think it would be an overreaction to dictate, hey, Tyrese Maxey, you do this. We could see it. And now Maxey starts the second. We feel better about it. I doubt we'll see Embiid because when he kind of has it going, you kind of got to give him this chunk and then, okay, take a rest, big fella. Harder to start and go there. I just think it'll be interesting. Now, the Knicks did get the benefit of Karl-Anthony Towns having limited minutes. So we've seen them sprinkle him in with the second unit, especially as that Hawks series went on. Mm-hmm. How intentional will they be about that in game two? I mean, it was kind of handed to them to a degree where it was like, yeah, we're going to
– You got to go, man. So now here you go.
So I'm intrigued because he set the tone and helped lift that unit up, and that's been a theme for them. So it's interesting. Like, this is the fun of a game one. The Knicks established the tone. Now it's on the Sixers to reply, respond, and see what they can knock off the table. If you're the Knicks, we just need to make some of these people feel uncomfortable. I think that's where the Celtics didn't quite get to, where, okay, they are not uncomfortable offensively. They are able to flow and do exactly what they want because they know how we're going to react. The Knicks didn't give them that in game one. So how do the Sixers respond offensively and defensively? Can't be this. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see how they respond, but the Knicks did exactly what they were supposed to do. And this is the playoff ceiling of the New York Knicks. This is what we thought they could do. This is what I preached during the season. Like, hey, I understand what you're saying, but if they get into these playoffs, they can be this kind of team on both ends of the floor, and they did it in that game one.
Yeah. So this is, I think, three straight games in which they held a 30-point lead, or three straight playoff games, rather, which they've held a 30-point lead. That's generally not how it's supposed to work. So the testament to how they've closed things out, the way that they have been able to find their rhythm on both ends of the floor. So very impressive stuff there. We will see how the Sixers adjust. You hit on a little bit earlier. This will be our last thing. I did audibly cackle when we got to Hakimich in the first quarter. I was like, Nick Nurse is pulling out all the stops in this basketball game. Got some early aerial help, 40 minutes. Then they dip under the 2 minutes. Mitchell Robinson comes back in. It's like, okay, this is cool. And I'm just, in general, I guess related to that, I'm keeping an eye on when the Knicks decide to deploy the double big lineup, because I do think that can put the Sixers in some interesting positions from a lineup perspective, from a matchup perspective. We didn't see like the heavy offensive rebound game for the New York Knicks in this one because the game was just frankly over. But moving forward in this one, I'm expecting a better game two effort. So I'm curious to see what that part is going to look like.
Well, I'll hang there real quick. Do they need to go double big? It's kind of on Philadelphia to make New York feel like they have to. If the Knicks can just kind of have a five on the floor because the Sixers will have to have a five on the floor, that's where it gets interesting. But then we get into the do the Sixers start cross-matching? Do they try and turn things into a different switch situation? Like, it's interesting. But, like, ideally, if you're New York, the double big lineup is fantastic. I would like to not have to use it because now I have Kat involved and engaged, and I have Mitchell Robinson doing what he does. And then, okay, I don't want to put myself in a position where you got to remember that Sixers lineup is smaller, their best one to the degree, their starting lineup. And so do I really want to have one of them having to close out the perimeter or deal with drives if I don't have to? And so I think that was one of the things that was interesting early, especially the balance as far as how New York wanted to treat Joel Embiid and when they decide to double. And you saw Kelly Oubre being like, yeah, I'll cut because you have to deal with Maxey, Edgecombe, and Paul George space. So I don't know if they want to tap that unnecessarily in this series.
Okay. I got you. Like, I think if you're going to do it, to your point, you want to do that from a position of strength more so. Oh, snap. We got to find something because the Sixers are dinging us. They did have the early run in that first half where they end up winning those minutes. But something I'm just keeping an eye on that front. But again, salute to the Knicks, Sixers. You're going to have to be better in this one. And I think there are multiple pathways for them to be better. To the nightcap, Steve. The Minnesota Timberwolves with Anthony Edwards in tow. We talked about this series on Friday. Like, he's going to try to work his way back. Is he back in game 3? Is he back in game 4? Like, when he does come back, which version are we going to see? What if I'm just available at the start of the series? Which is insane to me. Shout out to youthful exuberance. But more importantly, the Minnesota Timberwolves stealing home court. They get the game 1 victory, 104-102 in the win. Steve, what stood out to you in this one?
Everything stood out to me, Nikias. Everything did. I think just to bounce off the dynamic here, the Minnesota Timberwolves, when it comes to spring, once tax day has passed, you got to deal with them in a different way than you had to. And Anthony Edwards decided, you know what? When be playing, I'll play. But Ant, your knee. No, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. That dynamic between, like, when you watch that game, Victor Wembanyama helping off Rudy Gobert and Anthony Edwards just deciding, I absolutely do not care about that, is phenomenal. This is a really fun playoff matchup as far as the back and forth goes. And I think this series is a reminder of what Minnesota can be on both ends of the court. I think it's going to be interesting as this series goes on, who establishes their defense and what does that mean? Because it feels like when each team decided, okay, we're getting stops, they got to run. We don't have to execute in the half court. We can breathe a sigh of relief. But You had moments and pockets where it's like, okay, the reps for Jaden McDaniels really paid off. Because even Anthony Edwards came off the bench, right? And there was a moment, and hate to be all over the place because I'm just excited to talk about basketball. The difference between how Minnesota operated when Victor Wembanyama was on the court and when Luke Kornet was on the court was insane. Have you ever sat and you're waiting for one person to show up so you guys can eat dinner, and that one person shows up? That's how the Timberwolves treated Luke Kornet's minutes. Oh, great. Glad you're here. You're not that guy. So I'm shifting points, but like, they were so intentional. And Wemby was great defensively. Like, that's the most block shots we've ever seen in a playoff game. But Minnesota was really intentional about and it's something you said in the preview, moving Wemby around the board, keeping him on the wing, keeping him from being low. The battleground, again, is once you show it to Wemby, he's going to adjust and find a way to get back towards the block or be in a help position. But I liked how Minnesota was like, okay, we're going to get you in action and attack. We're going to put you on the wing and then do a quick attack before you notice it. And then the Spurs being like, well, I don't want to do that. And so I think it was, I forget the exact set, but it was a high pick and roll. And there was like a wheel concept where Jaden McDaniels cuts from the corner. Anthony Edwards slides from the wing to the quarter. They kick the Ant. He gets a quick attack because Wemby's on the wing. And the next time they ran it, Wemby was on Jaden McDaniels. So when he cut, Wemby was just at the block.
Now I'm good.
And there were moments like where it's just like, I really don't care what you're running. I'm just going to get to this spot. We'll rotate around it. So the dynamic there is really interesting. What stood out to you? Because I love this series. I could ramble for 78 minutes about this basketball game.
Oh, no. I'm right there with you. And this is why, hey, we read the YouTube comments. Oh, that's all, though. But there's no Ant. This series is going to be interesting. Yes, it was. Yes, it is. And also, Ant's back already. So take that, YouTube commenters. But no, in all seriousness, the back and forth is where I start. And for me, as I was kind of getting my notes together for this one, I just kind of started with the Wolves had to search but found enough. Also, Wemby is literally the subheading in my notes based on what this game one was. Because to your point, I didn't expect this to be like a 115 offensive rating in the half court for the Minnesota Timberwolves unless they got insane shot making. But I did want to see, going back to Friday, what exactly were you going to try to do? Was this going to be pick and roll, draw the late switch? Was this going to be off-ball stuff to get you involved? Was this going to be on-ball stuff to get you involved? Which, fast forward to the fourth quarter very quickly, Terrence Shannon Jr., who insane drives this entire basketball game. Hey, Wimby, do you want to navigate pick and roll? Not only are we putting you in action, no, we are inverting things and making you navigate screens. Are you ready for that? I was like, okay, this is an interesting wrinkle. I want to see how the Spurs react to that in game two. You already hit on the other notes, so I won't hang there too long about how they moved Wimby around the board. But like that part was fun. To your point about how differently Minnesota was operating offensively with Wimby on the floor and when he wasn't there. About 25% of Minnesota shots came at the rim when Victor Wembanyama was on the floor. That jumped up to darn near 40 in the minutes when Wimby was off the floor. They took more threes with Wimby on the floor. 26 off the dribble jumpers with Wimby on the floor compared to 2 when he was off the floor. And I think even to that point, did I love every single off the dribble jumper that Minnesota took in that basketball game? I did not. And there were a lot of possessions where San Antonio was able to work Minnesota late into the clock when they were searching for things in the half court. But there was just a level of comfort of Wimby. If you are going to be in this super deep drop, Mike Conley's hunting pull-up threes. Anthony Edwards didn't mind hunting pull-up threes. Jaden McDaniels was looking for pull-up threes and pull-up twos in his basketball game. And it's just like, you may want cleaner looks more consistently, but you are going to have that level of comfort to take some of these shots to hopefully loosen the shackles of the half-court offense as this series going on. So, like, them moving Wimby around the board, them taking some of the shots that were available to them, them being intentional about how they wanted to push in transition, all of that felt important to me. And then the other big picture thought, and I swing it back to you, Steve, the way that the Wolves closed that game, like, aside from the TSJ pick and rolls, them saying, Jaden McDaniels, Naz Reid, Julius Randle, you are our closing front court in this basketball game. This has been a very perimeter-oriented game for Victor Wembanyama, and I have my questions about that we can get to. But we need a little bit more mobility on the perimeter. We want y'all to be able to handle some of these drives, some of these pick-and-rolls they're running for Wimby. And ultimately, y'all are able to kind of get into the body, bother to handle and things like that to take some of these drives off the table. And on the other end, because we have all three of these guys that can attack in different ways and can space to varying degrees, we go from Victor Wembanyama on Rudy Gobert and hopefully staying near the basket to, okay, we kind of have to put him on Terrence Shannon Jr. now because we're not putting him on Ant. We don't really want to put him on Randall. We don't really want to put him on Naz Reid because of how they use him. Like, that was an interesting chess match to me that I'm curious to see how the Spurs deal with that in game two moving forward.
Well, again, this is the challenge of dealing with Wimby because eventually he'll decide, or the Spurs coaching staff will decide, we're going to do this, and now you have to deal with the adjustment. Mm-hmm. This is something that I'm glad you mentioned how the Wolves closed lineup-wise, because this was something that just rattled in the back of my brain watching this game. There's usually some question marks about Naz Reid and Julius Randle in the playoffs, especially in specific matchups. I think they grew a lot in that Denver series, and I think they've given the effort on both ends. I think you got to tip the cap to Julius Randle. One thing watching that game that just stood out to me, I typed it in my notes, but I was like, who's guarding Naz Reid and Julius Randle in this series? Not necessarily like the Spurs don't have people to do it, but it's like, oh, that's right. They're tall, they're big, they're physical, they can drive. And you see the Spurs lineups where it's like, okay, we have 2 or 3 guards. We have Champagne out here. We have Harrison Barnes. We have Kelton Johnson. And it's like, well, Julius Randle is putting his head down and putting his shoulder in the chest and going to move. Naz Reid is running pick and roll and seeing Wimby in a drop and saying, I'm going to take a pull up. And so you kind of unlock in your brain, is this a Naz Reid and Julius Randle series to a degree where they can now become pressure points in a different way than we had necessarily expected? Like, you go back to like the OKC series, and OKC was like, not you two, switch, don't care. We're keeping it in front. And the Spurs have to kind of get back to back. The Spurs have to get to a level where they have to take one or two of them away. But it was like jarring. You see the ball come out, you like scan the floor, and it's like, oh, that's a matchup they could attack. And you saw like Randle trying to get downhill, Reed trying to get downhill. So I'm intrigued by how they adjust there. But I think, how did you feel about the Spurs offense? And I asked that because in my brain, as you were watching that game, right? Minnesota's defending at a high level. They're aggressive and attacking offensively. The Spurs, as good as they are with movement, as good as their guard play is, they don't have a finisher right now. Like, they don't have the finishing move, which is interesting for the Wolves coming off a Denver series where they had super finishers as far as Jokic and Murray. And like, you have to deal with this move. Like, but the Spurs don't have that to a degree. So how did you feel about the Spurs offense?
I felt kind of odd about the Spurs offense due to this one. And this, again, this was more of a defensive battle, as we both alluded to on Friday and, you know, earlier in this conversation. 82.6 half court offensive rating for the Wolves, not good. 80 offensive rating in the half court for the San Antonio Spurs, also not good in this one. And I think from a process perspective, and I think it kind of ties into the way that the Wolves closed, it felt so perimeter based for the San Antonio Spurs. And like, that isn't always bad. You know, we've been talking throughout the year. I like the Spurs early offense. They're going into their flares. They can kick it on the perimeter and then get to their drive and kick that way. They can invert it with Wimby pick and rolls. Stephon Castle can initiate. Dylan Harper, when he comes up the bench, he can initiate. De'Aaron Fox, et cetera. So like, they have a bunch of different options. I think your point that they don't have the firm, this is the pet set, this is the pet combo thing, or at least not consistently so, it really stood out in this basketball game. Because once you couldn't get to the, I always think of the Sixers, where it's like, you know, Tyrese Maxey bringing it up the floor, Tobias Harris running behind him, just a quick pitch to him to drive. Spurs did that a bunch for Wimby to get him downhill. Outside of that, I don't know if I felt like there was something that the Spurs were comfortable just getting to consistently. Like, they mixed in the Wimby pick and rolls, and if it didn't work, they kind of had to search. You get some Stephon Castle pick and roll. If they didn't have anything initially, they kind of had to search. It was a similar thing with De'Aaron Fox. They kind of had to search. And so I do kind of wonder what they feel like their method of their best method of attack in the half court is going to be in this series, especially if Minnesota is going to downsize to this degree, be comfortable switching in or pressuring to this degree. Like, what can the Spurs get to? Because I know a lot of people are going to look at the Wimby box score and see 0 of 8 from 3 and be like, hey, man, get your tall self down there. And, like, there is some of that. But also, like, how many middle touches did forget if it actually worked. How many middle touches did we get from Wimby in this basketball game? It didn't feel like a lot. Like, there was one around 3-minute mark of the fourth quarter where they get him a touch against Julius Randle at the free throw line, and he drew a foul out of that. But, like, I wish there was a little bit more intention about moving Wimby around offensively and getting him more work inside the arc. Because once the perimeter stuff kind of dried up, it felt more difficult.
Well, I mean, I think this is where, if you want to hand the Spurs some bail, okay, we know how Minnesota wants to guard them. So let's figure out how to kind of move the things around the board. So while they don't have the hard finisher, go back to that Portland series, and they said, Wimby, get in the corner. Someone's screening for you. We'll make that a pressure point. Mm-hmm. We'll play out of it. And so there are things they can get to. It's just going to be interesting to see in game two, what do they land on? I think the important part, and this kind of works for Minnesota and San Antonio, guard play is huge for San Antonio as far as they need to have those guys established as far as being able to get in the paint, being able to get their own baskets, being able to force help and make plays and just kind of have the flow up. And so it's intriguing where, in theory, you're looking at Jaden McDaniels and it's like, okay, maybe you won't have the same kind of impact that you had against Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic. But then it's Jaden McDaniels against Stephon Castle. And it's like, well, if you're keeping him out of the paint, that puts a whole lot of the pressure on De'Aaron Fox and or Dylan Harper to now replicate some of what you do. Because, you know, a lot of people have complaints about Stephon Castle, but his ability to run pick and roll, his ability to get in the paint, it's really important to San Antonio. So I'm intrigued to see Minnesota's kind of side. We'd like to turn his water down a little bit. Let's change that temperature. And so how does San Antonio adjust? Can they loosen things up for their guards? To your point, can they move Wimby around? This is the tricky part, though. They're so good defensively, even in a loss, they had opportunities to just run. And so that kind of lifts them up to a degree to now, when they have this defense playing at a certain level, they are able to run in transition, and now they have, we're going to attack this in the half court. That is where the blend gets really tough. So if you're Minnesota, you have to kind of try to work to avoid that. You got to make sure the guards are kind of held in check to a degree. And then you got to make it as tough as you can on Wimby. Because, again, once you've shown your hand, we're going to see how they adjust. Now, I'll go to the Anthony Edwards portion very quickly. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Again, I'm going back to the dynamic. Like, sign me up for Anthony Edwards against Wimby at any moment in time. It brings the best out of both of them. And Wimby does special things where it's like, what's wrong with this guy? And then Ant's like, I truly do not care. Glad to see you on a switch. Bop, bop, pull up. And like that, you got to enjoy that dynamic when you got it. How'd you feel about the Ant performance? Because I thought, like, going back and watching it back this morning, it was interesting because, like, it was a battle back and forth, and then it's like, hey, Anthony Edwards is coming in the game. And it's like, well,
this is different.
So how did you feel about it?
I had to, you will appreciate this, Steve. I had to turn my brain off a little bit when it came to the amp.
Wow, he did it. He did it.
Long-term storytellers for our long-term dunkers here. But no, I had to turn the brain off because on a very basic level, I was like, how on earth is this dude playing right now? Why is he available? Why did we go from, 1 to 2 weeks, we might actually see Ant in the series, to listed as questionable, to Ant is playing? I'm just like, what do you mean we got that in like 36 hours? That's insane. So there was that. And then just kind of looking at the on-ball slash off-ball blend for him, it was interesting. Like, seeing how many of his possessions in that fourth quarter in particular, where he scores, what, 9 of Minnesota's, like, first 11 or 13 in that quarter. It's a lot of, I'm starting off the ball, getting something, and now let's see what the wimby coverage is. Is this a drop? Cool, I got something. Is this a late switch? Cool, I got something. And Minnesota being able to play out of that. So that part was interesting. On the other end of the floor, I was very concerned about what I saw from Anthony Edwards defensively. And I think that is just the nature of he can't move as well as he can. Like, there's always, like, the general off-ball thing with Ant. But now that he's, like, physically compromised to a degree, there's also, like, okay, there may be avenues for the Wolves to just flat-out go after him defensively. Or if we are setting up some of the Wimby inverted pick-and-rolls, or we're going to Fox Wimby with an empty side, I want to see more of that in game two, by the way. Let's make sure Ant is the low man, and then let's see if Ant is ready to tag some of those, or just see what his off-ball decision-making is going to look like. That feels like low-hanging fruit for San Antonio to grab moving forward in this series, because I didn't think he was moving all that well. And even to the final possession of that game, where Julian Champagne nearly makes the game winner to render all this move for Minnesota. It's Ant kind of swiping at the ball after the rebound, didn't get it, and then just kind of jogging back. Just like, hey, big dog, this might be the last play of the game. You might want to get back there. So it's just kind of balancing. I'm excited that he's here. I want him to stay available in this series. I'm curious what the offensive blend is going to be. Defensively, I can't imagine the Spurs aren't watching the game back saying, hey, we might be able to poke at this dude a little bit if this is how he's moving physically.
I mean, for me, a basketball fan, it's let's just keep everyone healthy. Let's see what this looks like. Let's develop and watch this battle. But it's going to be interesting because if Ant is – like, is how long is Ant going to be on a minutes restriction? Is he always going to come off the bench? Is he going to be aligned? I had a joke in my head, like, what if it's just, hey, Ant, glad you're back. Attack these Luke Kornet minutes. And that kind of happened for a little bit. Yeah. I was like, well, that's interesting. But, okay, how does he elevate? How do they deal with it? But I thought, and also, give a salute to Mike Conley for making plays in big 2026 in San Antonio. I feel a personal responsibility to say that on this podcast. But I think if you look at both these series, it's the fun of game ones. And like, this is what builds you up to watch a game two. You know, you fall short, what is your response? And now I think you have a little bit more of an ability to be intentional on both ends of the floor, defensively, offensively, when you try and take things away. You've shown your hand to a degree. And look at this. Mike Conley, one of one. You always salute Mike Conley. But I think going back to this, like, I'm excited to see what these teams try and do in game twos. Like, I know game one losses can feel awful, especially if you lose home court advantage. But you now have some answers to some of the questions you had coming in. And now we get to respond and try and see if we can flip things. So fun basketball. Basketball's fun.
Basketball indeed. 12.6 assists, 0 turnovers for Mike Conley, plus 13 in his 24 minutes. And most importantly for me, Steve, 7 three-point attempts for Mike Conley. Again, him hunting pull-ups in this game, very pleasing to me. They're going to need that shot in this series. I'm giving them love. You know what? We're going to take a break here. When we return, we've got two series tipping off later tonight. We're going to have some fun talking through what these series can look like. Stay tuned. Thank you. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Steve, it is time to preview a pair of series that are tipping off later tonight. We start in the Western Conference, since we ended in the Western Conference in the last segment. We have the Thunder. We have the Lakers. For game one, at the very least, we will not have Luka Doncic or Jalen Williams, respectively, for their team. So, obviously, their health is going to loom large over the course of this series. We've seen some video of Luka working out the practice facility and things like that, but still don't know when he's going to be able to return, if he's able to return. The Thunder swept the regular season series against these two teams. And as across all four of these matchups, players were missing and different things, I was like, okay, what is the healthiest version of this matchup we can find? That would be the April 2nd matchup between these two teams, in which Shai still having the MVP caliber season. Luka Doncic was coming fresh off of that insane March. The Lakers are rolling. It's like, oh, snap, MVP showdown. This is going to be fun. And the Thunder effectively ended that game in 14 minutes.
Hold on. Now I'm going to let you keep going, but I think it's really important when you think about this series, because you have to remember, and we talked about the Lakers for, I feel like, two consecutive weeks in the buildup, just because of how well they were playing. And it's like, ooh, this is the test. This is how we see if that, what's the production of the switching. How do they deal with LeBron? How do they deal with Luka? And the Thunder said,
hey, what if we turn you over?
and then we lose Luka and the whole season changes to a degree. So I just wanted to reestablish the context there, but keep cooking.
Yeah. So it's just like, it got hazy very quickly, and then Luka, to your point, and then Luka got hurt on top of that, which is why we are here. Where it's like, okay, we don't really know what the Luka variable is. But as I enter this series, like, this becomes kind of a tempo thing for me. But I also just kind of look at the Lakers offense overall. And my base question is, what exactly are you going to look to poke at? And can you get the Thunder to react based on what you're trying to poke at? Because as I was trying to look through, you know, previous games between those two, let me look at the LeBron possessions. How often are they putting two on the ball against LeBron? They didn't really do that against LeBron James. You think about some of just the general matchup between these two teams. If LeBron's going to be your nominal four, you're going to see Chet Holmgren on LeBron James. You're going to see Isaiah Hartenstein on DeAndre Ayton. The Lakers in this playoff run and in different parts of the season, they've had success with the LeBron James, DeAndre Ayton pick and roll. If you switch, LeBron can roast. If you go drop, LeBron can drive, or DeAndre Ayton can just get to these mid-range jumpers, etc. Against the Thunder, they didn't really have that success. It was very much a dare. LeBron, if you can knock down jumpers off the bounce, cool, but we're not sending a third defender to flood the zone or anything like that. If you make these jumpers, cool. If you don't, then we get the rebound and we get the push and transition against y'all. DeAndre Ayton, if you're going to take these shots, cool. If not, you're not going to have much fun. And so, like, the LeBron element is interesting to me. And if you can't get stuff in the half court, you're going to have to get it in transition. But then you look at what the Thunder are able to do against the Lakers in direct season matchups. Transition frequency overall dropped 4 percentage points, the equivalent of the last team in the NBA in terms of how often the Lakers were able to get in transition in these OKC matchups. When you're talking about pushing off of misses, overall this year, the Lakers were able to do that on roughly 29% of their possessions. I'm going to get the board. It's the Luka outlet, it's LeBron outlet, whatever the case may be. Against OKC, a shade under 20%. That also would have ranked last in the NBA. So it's just like, where do the Lakers find their advantages in this one? And tying into the tempo point, it's like, how fast do you even want to play against this Thunder group? Because you then risk them forcing turnovers and putting you into that loop. And so that's where I started, at the very least. I do have some pro-Laker thoughts, to be clear. But that's kind of where I started with this one. Like, they are going to have to flip some stuff against the Thunder.
No, it's a challenge. And, like, I want to establish before I continue on, I think the Oklahoma City Thunder are a machine. And I think the tough part for the Lakers is a lot of what they could bring to the table probably would have dinged last year's Oklahoma City Thunder team more than this year's Oklahoma City Thunder team. Because this is a team that, one, the defense is outstanding and is ever-present, and offensively, it's hard. It's a lot harder to bomb them down. They just feel more comfortable with the answers they found, and they grow throughout. But it's a long time ago, but I worked for the Memphis Grizzlies grit and grind era. I worked for the Brooklyn Nets. I always put my hat on where, how can a team figure a thing out to win a series? What could they possibly do to get a team in a box? So I'm going to throw some things out there, right?
Okay.
If you're the Lakers, right? Obviously, you're going to try and work to switch. Contain drives. Show early help. Try not to turn the ball over. Avoid fouling. To your can-they-run portion, they'd have to be timely with transition. they can't get into a track meet with OKC. But if they're able to get stops, get easy ones, set their defense, they put themselves in a position. All of this is incredibly much easier said than done. But you saw growth from DeAndre Ayton. You saw growth from Luke Kennard. You saw growth from Marcus Smart. Those guys are a little bit different than the people we saw in the regular season as far as the responsibility they have and the production they've had. So can the Lakers switch? Because, again, can they switch? How much do they want to double? Mm-hmm. Will they double? What are the rotations behind it? Are they more equipped to do that? You know, Austin Reeves come back, but are they more equipped to kind of execute that at different times? Can they make the rotations they want to make in this series versus Oklahoma City forcing them to rotate because of dribble penetration or pick and roll or drives? Can we bother Chet Holmgren, take him off the board? Can we put ourselves in a position where, hey, Shea, you're going to do this. We're going to try our best to defend as a team, but we're not going to foul you, and we're going to try and take these people off the board. To the Lakers' offense portion, they are not in a position where they can get in a track meet, like I said, but they can't unbelievably play slow. So it's not a controlled tempo series. But the Houston series may have given them some lessons as far as, okay, can we poke at certain things? Can we poke at certain matchups? Can we get what we want and now make you make a decision? Now, again, it's OKC, so they feel comfortable with the amount of people they have. But it's like, okay, how many matchups can LeBron win? How many matchups can Austin Reeves win? Can DeAndre Ayton punish certain switches? What do Marcus Smart and Luke Kennard look like? Are they going to be aggressive? Can we do enough to kind of take, like, this is going to be blasphemy to say this, but like, because OKC is so good, but like, okay, Houston tried to do so many different things, right? And they wanted to switch and stay at home against LeBron, and okay, we're just going to do this. Can we just execute some of those against OKC, even though they're a lot better and a lot stronger defensively? Can we hit some of these same notes in this series, even though they have different personnel and they may treat us differently? Can we tap into that? Am I crazy to say that? Because you lean to the other side, which you've never leaned to. You usually lean this way.
No, like I think that part's fair. And I think that base question of like, what can we take from previous series and add into our game plan or just accentuate with what we do, that's going to pop up a lot when we get to the Eastern Conference series that we're going to preview. But I think that is a fair thing to bring up in this case. I think to the Lakers offense point, I am fascinated to see like who gets the Luke Kennard assignment. Because again, like as that series went on, we went from, okay, we're going to have this guy on Luke Kennard to Amon Thompson. Actually, you guard Luke Kennard. We are taking the shot making off the board, et cetera, et cetera. Like what kind of priority is OKC going to put on him? Because Luke Kennard, with his work as a screener on or off the ball, just the general things that you can run for him, curling off staggers, curling off of pin downs, et cetera, the flares, he can unlock so many different things for the Lakers in the half court. And so I'm curious how often the Lakers want to tap that button. And, you know, to the other side, okay, are we going to put Lu Dort? We're going to put size on LeBron. We'll put another guy on Austin Reeves. Do we want to put Lu Dort on Luke Kennard just to make sure actually you're just not getting the movement shooting element in this series at all? Like, I'm fascinated by that portion of the program. And so, like, what can they poke at really looms large for me in this series. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was going to ask a question. Is what's more key for the Lakers? LeBron James being able to beat specific wings or guards for the Thunder? Or LeBron being able to poke at the Thunder bigs? Which would you say is more important?
I would probably say it's the Thunder bigs. I guess, like, the answer that I have, honestly, is that the answer is probably it's more important for him to poke at the Thunder bigs. It might be easier for LeBron to poke at the wings or the guards, though. So I'm kind of splitting hairs there. But like, if you can in some way take Chet or Isaiah Hartenstein off the board and you are now forcing OKC into more single big looks, that does open some things up for you. That does open up a level of mismatch hunting offensively that you could tap more into. And now, as I mentioned, the Thunder, I think LeBron saw a second defender on 14% of his touches against OKC during the regular season series. One of his highest marks against any opponent, but still a relatively low number. You compare that to like Shea or something. does that now get to like 18 or 19% because you're seeing more single big lineups and now LeBron gets to poke at things. You get back to the LeBron post-up bag and now it goes from showing early bodies to sending doubles. Now you get some shot making from Rui Hachimura, who has he missed a three in this postseason? I don't know. Marcus Smart knocks down threes. Luka Doncic knocks down threes. Like there are roadmaps to get here if you are able to get a Chet Holmgren foul trouble game or an Isaiah Hartenstein foul trouble game. We saw that early in the Phoenix series, for example. So, yeah, that's probably my answer. But I do just have my concerns on how consistently LeBron can poke at those bigs based on what we saw during the regular season matchup.
I mean, I think it's going to be important. And so you mentioned the blend that the Lakers had in that Rocket series. They have to kind of try and find that. And if you go back to the Sun series, they never found that. And that was kind of their foundation. It was just like, hey, we're going to make life tough on your star. And then if you want to move the ball, we're going to be physical and deny. And it was interesting because like JJ was like, hey, they don't foul. And I think a lot of people will talk about that quote in a different way. But I think it's just trying to prepare his team for a, hey, we're just going to have to, we're going to have to try and rush. Like we're going to have to rush like in like first and 10, second and 7, third and 5. Hope he went on third down type beat. And so that's where my curiosity goes. It's less like disrespect to the Thunder, but I always started playoff series with questions and curiosity. And then, okay, if we get definitive answers, let's talk about it. But what could happen if this thing happens? That's just where my brain goes. So,
no, I think that's fair. I do want to quickly, I feel like this has been a lot of what can the Lakers do, and understandably so, they are going to be the rightful underdogs in this series. I will say a big part of that, you already talked about the defense. One, I'm curious to see how much zone we see from the Lakers. They were third in zone rate overall in the regular season, slightly higher rate in the OKC matchups. As you've talked about before, Steve, the Thunder team in 2024 that was dealing with zone and having to navigate that is not this year's version of the Thunder. That C zone was like, all right, cool. Someone to the middle, screen the inside of this. We got a look, et cetera, et cetera. There is still, since we're in the playoffs, since we're dealing with small samples, there is just an element of even if OKC does the right thing, their role players do just have to make threes in this series. And if they don't, this does open up another pathway for the Lakers. So just keep an eye on that front. I just want to quickly talk about Shea, who was, you know, had the bad shooting performance in game one against Phoenix, but has otherwise just been insane. Against the Lakers this year, 28-8, 64 true shooting, 1.2 points per possession on trips featuring a Shea pick and roll, nearly 1.3 points per possession on trips featuring a Shea drive. And this is with Shea seeing a second defender or more on roughly 26% of his touches. The Lakers have thrown a lot of him. And at least during the regular season matchups, they did not find consistent answers against that guy. So it is, one, a salute to Shea Gilgeous-Alexander. And from the Thunder side, you want to make sure he maintains his balance. He's able to get to the mid-range. He's able to get to the line. He's able to unlock these drives in light of how the Lakers want to load up their help. And when they get to these zones and these hybrid man looks, like, can he diagnose that quickly? I am confident that he will, but he does have to do it. And from the Lakers, is there anything you can take off the board for Shea Gilgeous-Alexander in this one? Like, I don't know how much you want to put two on the ball against him, unless you were just being super audacious, helping off of Lu Dort when he's in, Cason Wallace when he's in, et cetera. And again, it ties back into the role player shot-making portion of the program. But Shea is fantastic. Lakers obviously got to do something to make him uncomfortable in this series. Curious to see what that part looks like. And this is going to be a big one for Chet. Going to spend some time on LeBron, but he's going to see a lot. He's going to see LeBron. He's going to see Rui Hachimura. I would imagine we're going to see at least a little bit of Jared Vanderbilt in this series. Just throw a different look there. Chet will still have to win against wings. And with Jalen Williams out, he becomes like the primary guy in that regard outside of Shea to do that. So he has to handle his business on that front as well. But I do think this is an uphill climb for the Lakers in this series. So we will see what that portion is going to look like. Steve, do you have any closing thoughts, questions, anything that interests you about the series before we move?
No, I mean, I think the next time you hear from us in the series, we will have seen two games of basketball. So it'll be fun to see what exactly has occurred. I would like to talk about the Eastern Conference matchup. I would like to talk about the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Detroit Pistons. And this one feels like the most culture shocky series to a degree, where like, but also it feels like the most we're so back series to a degree for either of these teams, right? Both of these teams got taken to their limits in unique ways. Like Orlando had the formula. We play defense. We're timely on transition. We keep pressure on you. We mix up shot making. Let's go. Toronto brought the physicality and the defense to Cleveland's door and some. What is Detroit's calling card? Defense. So what gets interesting to me in this series is who breathes that first sigh of relief, that, buddy, that paycheck showed up on time. I'm not late to the year, but whatever it is, who gets that first one? For Detroit, this is not Orlando, right? And while they have Evan Mobley, they have Jared Allen, not every lineup Cleveland throws out there is going to have the same level of size and length that Orlando threw out there. So can you attack matchups? Can you put Mitchell and Harden in action? Remember, Kate Cunningham decided and looked at the Magic and said, I'm cycling through a whole lot of y'all. And by the end of that series, Orlando didn't feel comfortable with some of those switches they did early. Can Detroit get to Jared Allen in pick and roll? And I hate to say that because Jared Allen was phenomenal in that Toronto series, especially in that game seven. But if you're Detroit, can we do that? Does Cleveland want to start with his coverage? Do they want him to switch? Orlando had a lot of success switching. If they don't want him to switch, guess who gets to roll, Nekias Duncan? That's right, Jalen Duren, who likely is so glad he never has to see the Orlando Magic ever again until, the next season. But can they unlock Duren as a roller? Does that open up more things for the offense? It looks different. Flip side, right? Cleveland, much stronger offensive team than the Orlando Magic. Like, Orlando had the... Pardon my French. Pardon my Espanol. They had the bleep it wee ball.
I did not know where you were going with that. Oh, my. Continue.
Trust me. Come on. I'm responsible.
I do.
But they hit Detroit in a different way. And there were a few games where Detroit wasn't getting back in the same way. They weren't keeping the ball in the front the same way. They weren't as clean in pick and roll. The rotations and help weren't as strong. Boy, you can't afford to do that against Cleveland. And so if Cleveland is going to be able to get Detroit in rotation, what does that open up? And now how much pressure does that put on Detroit's offense to show up? Like, they had a defensive battle against Orlando, but if Cleveland's able to do the offense thing, just like they did against Toronto, it's not fun. We saw the first two games of that series. It's not fun. So does it open the door for Detroit to mix in switching? With James Harden, Donovan Mitchell being hubs, does that allow them to game plan a little bit more? Like, Paolo was game, but it's also like, how is Paolo getting the ball? Is he just going to do stuff? If you guys are specifically doing this for Donovan, this for James Harden, can we take things away and take it off the board? So that's kind of my opening sequence. What do you think?
No, I'm right there with you. I think my base question for this one is, like, how did these first round series prepare these two teams for each other? And I thought back as I was prepping for this one to the Pistons episode that we did with Kuka Hill. And we were talking about what are favorable matchups for Detroit, et cetera. And I think, at least with me and him, the matchup we landed on that we do not really love for Detroit is Cleveland. Because it's a heavy dose of, you have this high-level guard play. On the other end, Evan Mobley, you guard Asar Thompson. You just do not get the paint. You just don't get it. You can try, okay, you can put your head down. You're going to have to deal with limbs in the paint, depending on where you have Asar Thompson. And if you take him out, you put in Ron Hall and someone else, we're still parked near the paint, et cetera. And so I am fascinated to see, like, how much of that rings true in a playoff setting. Because regular season series, these two teams were tied 2-2. But, a couple of those matchups happened before the Harden trade. Had some injuries in the other two matchups since those trades are happening. So, like, it is going to be a relatively new matchup for these two teams. But some of the base themes, I think, remain the same. And so, does Cleveland breathe a little bit easier offensively? I'm curious to see what it looks like. To your point about Detroit, there is just a level of switchability and size that Orlando had that Cleveland doesn't have in the same way with some of their lineups. The starting lineup, actually, that's probably where I start with Cleveland, honestly, on a more basic note. Is Dean Wade just going to be your starting three in this series? Or are you going to stick with, like, a Max Strus, or you go smaller with Sam Merrill to further open up the offense? Like, this feels like a Dean Wade series to me. So we can get into some of the cross-matching and have that size, have that cross-matching, wall off the paint, make things difficult for Detroit. So we'll see what happens on that front. I am fascinated there. The other thought that I had in relation to some of these matchups, and I want to make sure I am, like, super clear of my words. Like, the Pistons not having a Scottie Barnes defensively is fascinating to me. And I say that while acknowledging, I think Asar Thompson should be all, first team all defense. I think in a vacuum, he is a better defender than Scottie Barnes. But where Scottie brings a different element is that this is 6'8", 6'9", that you can put on James Harden to deal with some of the strength-based drives with also having some screen navigation chops on top of that. to where, again, did Scotty win literally every rep against James Harden? He did not. But that is a way to limit some of what Cleveland wants to get to offensively and to shift some of the responsibility to Donovan Mitchell, where he struggled for large parts of that series against Toronto, particularly after game two. I don't know if the Pistons can hit that same note. And so I do just have a general, where are you putting Ausar Thompson in the series? Are you putting him on Donovan Mitchell and saying, James Harden, we dare you? Are you putting him on James Harden and saying, Donovan Mitchell, we dare you? Are you putting him on Evan Mobley and saying, actually, you know, Cade, whoever else, y'all defend the guards, I'm just going to muck things up because I am coming off of one of the best non-center defensive series of all time, is what Ausar Thompson just put together against Orlando with the weak side steals, the blocks, and the overall rim protection there. Where are they going to move him around? And, like, what can Cleveland do or what can they generate based on where Ausar Thompson is? Like, that is something that is very prevalent in my mind when it comes to this one. I think that's going to dictate who's able to establish their offense earlier. If the Cavs can, it gets a little interesting for Detroit. If the Cavs cannot, even when Detroit was struggling offensively in their series, they were pretty consistently able to get out in transition against Orlando. If they're able to put a stop on Cleveland's offense in the half court, like we saw in five games against Toronto, post game two, Detroit can still live with that formula. So, like, I know I'm all over the place, but I am excited, Steve. Like, there's a lot to sink teeth into when it comes to this one.
Well, considering you said Ausar Thompson's not Scotty Barnes, I just have to quote the great lyricist. What was it? Knees weeks, mom spaghetti, something like that. I don't know. But Ausar Thompson is going to move around the board. So you can have him active on ball against a specific matchup. But we also saw him have impact off ball in the Orlando series as far as, well, Paolo's trying to post up and take a block. So I think Ausar Thompson's really, really good at defense. And so I would not underrate his ability to impact this one. The key is just, okay, how many people do you feel comfortable with James Harden guarding? How strong is Tobias's defense in the series? How strong is Duncan Robinson's defense in the series? Can you keep the ball in front? Are you clean with your help? Are you clean with your rotations? I think if you answer a lot of those questions, Toronto gave you a little bit of a blueprint. Can you execute on that and be good? If the defense is great for Detroit, they always put themselves in a great position to win. If Cleveland is able to poke at that defense to open things up, they put themselves in a great position to win. The funny part is, both of them did that in their first series. Cleveland sent a message to Toronto, said, you can't guard us. Toronto figured it out. They had to fight. Detroit's defense got dinged. Detroit figured it out. They had a fight. So it's all about the attempts in this one. So I can't wait to see what game looks like. And, you know, we'll talk about it Friday.
That we will. I'm glad you brought up Tobias Harris because I was, if you weren't going to. And again, like the Ausar Scotty point was literally just a size difference between those two and that level of cross-matching. And if you are going to put Ausar like Donovan Mitchell per se, and you want to cross-match in any real way, that is going to put Tobias Harris underneath the spotlight here. Like, how often can you defend James Harden and deal with those drives? And what is that part going to look like? So, hey, I'm excited. This is going to be, I think it's going to be a muggy series, Steve. I'm excited to see what it is going to look like. But we can take a break from here. And when we return.
Wait. Before we take a break, you and Tobias Harris is the most will they or won't they basketball thought I've ever seen from you. Because on one hand, you're like, we got to respect Tobias Harris. And this goes back to like 2014 or something like that. On the other hand, it's like, ooh, Detroit doesn't have all ball creation. And what's the defense? Hot and then you're hot and you're cold.
Go ahead. I will say on a serious note before I toss it to break, I think with Tobias in particular, like there is just a level of shot making that he has to hit. Like the three largely didn't fall for him in that first round series, but he did just have timely shot making elsewhere and really popped off in the game seven in particular. But the defense, I feel like he's been pretty underrated in the playoffs on that end for a few seasons now. Like he's taken on some tough assignments during the playoff career. The shot making just kind of falls short, and that's where a lot of criticism comes in. But hey, we will see. I do think Tobias Harris deserves a salute. Very good first round series overall, and he's going to be massively important to Detroit as we shift to this one. Now, we officially take a break, and when we return, we shift to the W. It's preview time, Steve. It's contender check time. We're going to have some fun. Stick with us. We'll be right back. And we're back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Steve, time to shift to the W. The regular season starting on Friday. We're getting into two parts of a regular season preview. We start with a little bit of a contender check-in, but before we get there and talk through some of these teams, a couple of quick news nuggets. One, just a general salute to future Hall of Famer Tina Charles, who announced her retirement earlier today. One of the best bigs we've had in the league. One of the most talented scorers we had in the league. And like even watching her in Connecticut last year, give me the ball. I will get buckets. I will sprinkle in these jumpers. I will take threes if necessary. I will put smaller defenders underneath the basket. And defensively, I'll still work up to the level if you need me to. And so just wanted to give the quick salute to Tina Charles and acknowledge what a great career that she had. And also on the news front, Natasha Cloud has signed with the Chicago Sky. We're going to talk about the Sky on Friday's episode, so we will get deeper thoughts on her fit there and just overall the outlook for Chicago. But did want to also salute Natasha Cloud, as she was easily, if not the most heralded, just certainly the most interesting free agent left on the market. So glad she was able to find a team, one-year deal with Chicago Sky before the regular season starts. So again, we'll get deeper Cloud slash Sky thoughts on Friday, so don't be alarmed. But wanted to make sure we got those news nuggets out before we got going. Now, Steve, it's time to talk about what are projected to be some of the best teams in the WNBA, teams that were in the championship hunt last season, some teams that put themselves in position to do so. I think it is only fair that we start with the team that literally won the championship last season, and that is the Las Vegas Aces. End up winning 30 games after famously hovering around, being slightly under 500. They reel off an insane winning streak to close out the regular season. Then we get to the playoffs. The Storm take them to the brink. Okay. The Fever, or what was left of them, take them to the brink. It's like, okay. And then it's a sweep in the WNBA Finals. It's like, well, all right. Well, that's how you cap off a season like this. And so for me, Steve, just a basic what interests me, what concerns me type beat. On a basic level for the Aces, there is still just a lot of star power here, headlined by Asia Wilson. And so, as always, I am curious about how is Asia going to be used? We've seen an uptick in off-ball movement where she's receiving screens and receiving staggers and being able to attack that way. We see her get to grab defensive rebounds and push. We saw an uptick in pick-and-roll volume with her as the handler last year. When talking to Becky Hammon during training camp, she said, hey, this is a thing that we want Asia to do a little bit more of. Asia's alluded to the same. So just in general, what is the Asia usage going to look like? And we've already discussed it, you know, earlier this year And we discussed it a couple of weeks ago when the signing happened. But Kennedy Carter as a Las Vegas Ace, we've gotten some preseason film on tap now. But just in general, what is a full season of Kennedy Carter going to look like in Las Vegas? Why is she going to look off the bench? Will we get to a point to where she's starting at some point? That is where my intrigue starts with the Las Vegas Aces. On a very simple note, I'm a little concerned about what the perimeter defense is going to look like. We can dig a little bit deeper into it shortly. But Steve, what interests you about the Las Vegas?
Before we start your annual concern about the Las Vegas Aces perimeter defense, which we've done for the last 4 to 5 years, God bless. I think the most interesting concept to me is the gamble or the bet on the Aces having a level of consistency and continuity and being able to try and elevate what they found last year. And so that's where my brain goes. When you have Asia Wilson on your team, you are going to be in the conversation to win a championship. I think that's just point blank. Jackie Young can continue to grow and get better and be used in different ways, off ball, on ball. I think we all agree on that. And Chelsea Gray, one of the best point guards I've seen play the game of basketball. When you have those three, you're just going to be in this level of conversation. What else is behind it becomes the important part for me. So Melissa Smith, I feel like, helped them a lot in that second half of the season, and you found some chemistry. Okay, what does it feel like fully ingrained into the Aces system? Stephanie Talbot has a skill set that could unlock some lineup versatility as far as I can space the floor, I can defend multiple players, we can do different things. Does that unlock something different? Kennedy Carter, hey, a bucket. Does that unlock some different lineup combinations? Does that unlock some different scenarios of closing wise? And so for me, it's just thinking about how Becky Hammon believes in this team, but also pushes this team to grow and believe in themselves. And so if we're talking about continuity, and it's important in the W, you get off to a hot start, do the Aces find themselves in a position where we know who we are more, a lot more than we did last year? And even if we are not the A-plus version of ourselves, we're still a team you have to deal with in a different way. How important is that for them to start? And now, okay, do we have a little bit more versatility in our back pocket as opposed to just having to scramble like we did last year and eventually end up being, let me check my notes, the WNBA champions?
No, I think that part is fair, and that's something that Becky Hammon has alluded to quite a bit, you know, looking at some of the training camp quotes and things like that. This is why the training camp roster was smaller than literally everyone else. Like, I just kind of want to know what I have, and it makes it easier for us to establish these habits and ultimately, to your point, Steve, be able to find ourselves on both ends of the floor a little bit quicker than we were able to last year. And based on what the opening schedule is like for the Las Vegas Aces, they're going to have to lean on that continuity. It is the home game on Saturday, the ring ceremony at T-Mobile Arena, and then they are immediately on the road for, I think, a four-game road trip. So they're going to get some early testing here to kind of find themselves. Now, quickly to my primary concern, when you have a team that is this good, like, it does become a level of nitpicking, understandably. But the Aces were not a top five defense last year. During that win streak, they certainly were, and they found it in the postseason. But overall, I think they were eighth or ninth in defensive rating. Early returns in the preseason, they have continued to lean into the switching. Against Japan, they got dinged quite a bit in that first half before turning it on in the third quarter. Against the Dallas Wings, oh boy, did the Wings have fun with their pace and their tempo and all the off-ball variations they were able to get into. The Aces had a time trying to figure out when we want to switch, how cleanly the switches are, what our physicality is going to be like, what our containment is like, etc. And so if there's one thing to kind of poke at with the Aces heading into the season, it's in a playoff setting, I think they can game play their way into it and it can be fine. During the course of 44 and trying to establish these habits, how good is this perimeter group going to be? Because I think from Jackie Young, who has said she, you know, she, one of her goals this year is to make the all-defense team. After Jackie Young, there is a little bit of a drop-off. I think Stephanie Talbot is going to be very important. They're going to need her to defend multiple positions versus that being more of a bonus. And so that part is going to loom large. With Kennedy Carter and Dana Evans, when she gets back healthy, Becky Hammon has talked about wanting to use them as kind of full court pressure options, defensively. They're going to need that navigation. How often can they hit those notes during the course of this regular season to put themselves in position to make another run? Chelsea Gray, we know how good she is defending up the positional spectrum. Very good. A lot of reps at her at the four last year. How often do the Aces want to tap that button across 44? Because I think in the playoffs, it's easy to tap that button, and Chelsea's going to be game. Can you manage that throughout the year? Can they hit those notes to be at a certain baseline during the regular season? That is where my concern comes in.
I mean, I think it's all about versatility. And so being able to have an ability to execute different schemes, and I think feeling more comfort with having a stronger base. So you may have concerns about, can we keep the ball in front? And that's valid, but same point. Do you remember how much the Aces were searching defensively last year and trying to be active and realizing, ooh, boy, this doesn't work, and landing on switching? And okay. So I think having a comfort and understanding what they can and cannot do, being able to kind of execute their rotations, keep the ball in front, feel comfortable trying different things in pick and roll. It's the attempts for the Aces in the regular season that are going to be more important than anything else. And so are they clean with their what they're trying to do, or are they getting hurt because they are opening things up? I think that's probably the line I would draw it as, because I think we've seen last year, this is the attempt, ooh, this doesn't work. Okay, if they are clean in what they're trying to do, it doesn't work, and they're able to pivot to trying something else, I think that's more important for them going into the playoffs. So I think you have to build the defense back up to a degree and now let that execute your offense, because you have a Melissa who can switch. You have an Asia who can switch. Do we want to switch all the time? How many guards do we want to switch? Talbot, how many positions do we want to switch? Like, there's questions, but like, if they can hone in on it, I think you will see the cake be baked in a different way this year.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Let's move to the New York Liberty. First, a bit of injury news, which kind of bakes into one of the concerns. Sabrina Ionescu suffered an ankle injury in the preseason game against Connecticut Sun, expected to be reevaluated in 2 weeks. And so that would take her out, I think, the first four games of the regular season at the very least. So just on a basic note for the New York Liberty, how healthy is their core going to be? But we'll get into the actual, like, on-court concerns a little bit later. I want to get the news note out first. What interests me about this Liberty group, Steve, as you know, doing this podcast with me, I am a huge proponent of skilled size. And the New York Liberty have a lot of skill size and thus a lot of different lineup combinations and a level of overall versatility that they can tap into that I am a fan of. When they got off to, what was it, the 10-1 start last year, and they had at that point in time, like, they were on pace for the highest net rating in W history, all these things, I was like, hey, there's a lot of 6'3", 6'4 players that can do a lot of things. Y'all can't score on them, and then they can also put you in a blend on the other end. So I am still very much enamored with that collective talent, the collective size that they have, and they're implementing Satu Sabally into this mix. And so that's where my excitement and my intrigue starts. What are these combinations going to look like? How are they going to look to attack within this new offense under Chris DeMarco? And how quickly can they hit the notes and put teams in a blender? And defensively, just how quickly are they able to put teams in a box? Are they going to be a high switch group? It's been a lot of drop for Jonquel Jones during preseason action at the very least, but like, what level of defensive versatility do they want to tap into early on? Like, those are things that are cute. Those are things that interest me. But that's where I start, Steve. This is a big skilled group. And like, that always yells super high floor to me when you have this kind of star talent on top of it.
The Sabrina injury is deeply unfortunate for the Liberty as far as being able to kind of get off to the start you need to. You need a sprint to start the W season. And also, salute to the city of Portland. The only times the Liberty play in Portland are at the start of the season, which is just
That is unfortunate.
But what I would say is, for the Liberty, it's an interesting time as far as being able to have a base that has had success and try and expound on it, and which attempts are going to land is where it gets interesting. Because we've seen a lot of Jonquel Jones and Stewie actions. We've seen a lot of trying to get to movement, using screens to open things up, and just trying to find their flow. And so the new offense feels like it's just emphasis on certain things. You have the dynamic of, oh yeah, that's right, Satu Sabally will also be involved in this. And that is kind of a little bit of a game changer to a degree. You're not really supposed to have Satu, Stewie, and Jonquel on the same team with their level of versatility. And now being able to have types of like Benaja, Laney Hamilton, Leone Fibish around that, like, it's just a lot of things, to your point, that they can put together to have two-way lineups. I think the biggest thing is probably just going to be, okay, can you establish your defense early as you're trying to figure some things out offensively? Because you're going to try and find some lineups as you're not as healthy as you want to be start the season. Mm-hmm. So who's going to be able to play with who? Can you establish the defense to a certain degree to where we know we're doing X, Y, and Z, and then offensively we can poke at different things, we can open different things up. The Liberty, at their peak powers, is a team that you do not have fun with on both ends of the floor. We're not having a good time guarding you, and we're not having a good time trying to score on you. And I think the lineup versatility they have, being able to fire Benaja and Leone at the same time, on top of Stewie, on top of Jonquel, on top of Satu, gives them that layer of, yeah, continuity, but also we can elevate this to a degree. And so I think they may have a slower start than people may anticipate. That could be trouble in this W. We saw that last year where it's like, who, like what the Liberty have done, you are facing Hoomst in the first round. But I think they are able to organically build on both ends a little bit better this year.
Okay, I like it. I think for me, on the concern pile, again, it's general health for me. Sabrina out for the first 2 weeks. We haven't seen Satu Sabally yet. And just in general, like, you just monitor like the overall health history of Stewie, who's played through some stuff last year. Jonquel Jones missed time. That, again, the Liberty started out, I think, 9-1 or 10-1. Jonquel goes down, and that's kind of where the overall spiral, you know, relative to how good they were. But the spiral kind of started when Jonquel went down. So, like, as talented as the top four is, you just want them to be healthy. And related to Sabrina being out in particular, you do not have Natasha Cloud anymore. Without Sabrina, who are your backup ball handlers? And, like, how trustworthy do you feel they are? And that may not be as important during the regular season, but within a playoff lens, I think that is something that is worth a timeout already. Go ahead.
We are not going to disrespect Maureen Yohannes in this house.
Hey, listen, we are no disrespect. Going to do that. All I am saying is that there's a bit of a step down in terms of the offensive explosiveness, the decision making, I think, more importantly. when Sabrina is out. And so, like, just how many backup ball handling options do the Liberty want to cycle through, and how productive are they going to be? You mentioned Marina Yohannes. I think on the high end, she can absolutely hit a lot of those notes, can be used on or off ball. The shooting's obviously going to be dynamic. She's going to juice the transition attack. Like, there are obvious positives there. I'm curious to see, like, how much of the burn Pauline Astier gets during the regular season, assuming that she makes the final roster. We're still getting, I think the final roster is going to be due on Thursday, so we'll have a firm picture of who everyone has. But I was intrigued by the Astier minutes during preseason play, particularly that Connecticut matchup. And so, like, does she soak some of that in? And, like, how quick is the learning curve for her? While Sabrina's out, or even when Sabrina comes back, does she snag some of those backup point guard minutes? Beyond that, again, it really is just kind of health for me, because they are just so talented on the high end, and that collective size can't really be matched by anyone at the high end. But it's going to be guard play, guard depth, and just overall health for me when it comes to the Liberty.
C'est incroyable, mon ami. I don't know what you mean.
Okay, continue. You got it. Okay. All right, fair enough. We move to the Atlanta Dream, Steve. Pretty active offseason. They retained their talent. They also traded for Angel Reese. Some encouraging returns during preseason action so far. And so for me, the intrigue starts with the general integration of Angel Reese. Not going to hang there too long. We've talked a lot about the Dream during preseason play, but just in general, what is the defensive usage going to be like? What coverages do they want? How often are we going to see her drive slash initiate versus spacing and screening? Just what is the balance going to be on ball and off ball on both ends of the floor for Angel Reese? Like, that's intriguing for me. And then baked into the actual core, what steps do we see taken forward from Ryan Howard, who at the high end is just one of the best players in basketball, flat out. Can just bend games in her wheel. Made her first all-defensive team last year because it was the most consistent effort we've seen from her defensively. Is she able to build on that? And maybe this is like first team Ryan Howard. I think she has the potential to do so. Offensively, we know what kind of shooter she can be. She closed the year out, I think last 8 or 9 games of the season, 44% from three on 10 attempts. You zoom out for the overall season, led the WNBA and made threes per game, but shot 32% from three. So, like, where does the overall efficiency land there? And then inside the arc, do the drives continue to grow? Do the foul drawing continue to grow? Does the playmaking continue to grow? If it does, and I am anticipating growth, to be clear, but depending on what level that growth is, we go from Ryan Howard as an all-star who can play like an all-W talent to Ryan Howard like MVP conversation. And so I'm excited to see how much of a step she takes this year. That's probably where I start, Steve. What excites you about this Atlanta Dream team?
They have an ability to tap into continuity and have a great start to the season, in theory, because we know what we want to get to. And so can their defense elevate what their offensive principles are? And so we know what Ryan Howard can bring to the table. We know what Alisha Gray can bring to the table. We know what Jordan Kanan can do to help us. Can we now defend at a higher level, have a higher level activity to mix in more transition to improve what we do in the half court flow wise? That's where my eye kind of goes to. And so the Angel Reese at the five portion is fun, because I think, again, I think she's been really active in the drop. I think on the offensive end, pick and roll, been really good at, as far as like working within the flow, but also getting to her roles quicker without just saying, hey guys, I'm slipping. Like, no.
I'm just getting out of here. I'm gonna roll.
And it was funny to watch the preseason, because it was like, hey, I would like to try this right hand shot as much as I possibly can. So can the Dream build on that foundation and get off to a hot start? Tina Pau, I think, had a tremendous preseason as far as just being aggressive and decisive. And so I think what you have with this team is just an ability to, we know what we want to get to offensively. We feel comfortable with our flow. If we can be better defensively, we can have more lineup versatility. We know exactly what we have. It gets interesting. Now, I'm not sure when Bree Jones comes back, right? But that's where I think things get interesting, because now you have to deal with a whole lot of stuff with us in the half. So establish your defense, play freely offensively. You can get off to a hot start.
Yeah, that Dream front court is just going to be a booger to deal with when they are fully healthy. And even just going back to their preseason stuff, their spacing principles, incredibly clean. We saw that last year, but the Memphis game in particular, just here's this pick and roll that we're flowing into. Someone's in the corner. We're lifting to the wing. You make a decision. Are you tagging this role or are you staying with the shooter? And the Dream were just able to consistently get good looks out of that, even if they didn't make them. And so they obviously, to your point, they have a lot they can build off of from last season. As far as concerns go, my eyes go to the point guard room first. If we're just setting aside overall health, you obviously want everyone to be healthy. I go to the guard room. because I think Jordan Canada, her drives, her playmaking, her point of attack defense can be important. Teams are also very comfortable ducking under her against in pick and roll, and when she is spaced, we are helping off of her. What is that going to look like? Tina Pau-Pau, who I agree with you, Steve, had a tremendous preseason to me. The shot making, the playmaking, just some of the poise making her pick and roll reads really impressed me. Teams are comfortable putting her in action defensively. So I am curious to see, like, as we get into some of the marquee matchups during the regular season or as we get into playoff time, what is the yin and yang between the point guard room going to be? Are you leaning on the shooting on Tina Pau-Pau and trusting we got enough length and overall defensive prowess to deal with that? Or are we dealing with Jordan Canada? It's like, okay, we trust that we can score enough elsewhere to even if they're helping off of her, we can still get to good stuff in the half court, which go back to that Fever series. They were kind of able to bog Atlanta down in the half court in some key moments, and it led to the upset ultimately. So that's kind of where I go in terms of concerns. What say you?
I think for me, it's just, okay, does the defense not grow? And then do teams feel comfortable with how we want to play offensively? Because we showed our hand last year. That's primarily my concern with the Dream. If we can kind of get into a world where we are able to be comfortable with guarding them and also we can attack them on the other end, that was my problem with them last year. They just have to alleviate that problem.
Okay, I think that's fair. Just the Dream against switches for me would probably be a big picture thing. And before we get out of here with Atlanta, mentioned Ryan Howard being excited about her growth. Alicia Gray was a top five MVP finisher coming off a career year. I am excited to watch her play basketball on both ends of the floor. Did not want to sneak out of here without some Alicia Gray love. Now, to the Indiana Fever, another team that we already talked quite a bit about during this preseason. General excitement, Caitlin Clark, welcome back. How much have you grown as a player? The early returns in the preseason is the drives are hitting more. The mid-range scoring is popping more. And then when you mix in the on-ball and off-ball blend in terms of the usage, and now we can get into Kelsey Mitchell initiating, Raven Johnson, when she comes in, she can initiate. And now I can fly off of stuff before attacking or setting up a pick and roll. I can be used as a screener for some of these inverted pick and rolls for Aaliyah Boston, which very quickly, it's not like Aaliyah didn't initiate some pick and rolls last year, folks. It's not entirely new. But that is a dynamic that I'm excited to see grow. And just in general, talked about it more so, you know, during and after the Unrivaled season. But I think Aaliyah Boston is primed for a really big year on both ends of the floor. And she popped in a real way last season. And so just Caitlin plus Aaliyah is where my intrigue really starts with this Fever group. And I'm over the moon with the Raven Johnson experience already. She's going to be one of the most electric defenders we have in basketball. So that's where my interest starts, Steve. What say you on the Indiana Fever?
We once again tapped the continuity button. And now Stephanie White having an understanding of where she wants to get to with this Fever team and having a roster she probably feels better about as far as like, you know, get well soon, Monique Billings. But if you have Aaliyah Boston and Monique Billings in that starting lineup, you got some versatility and some spacing you tap into. If you have Sophie and Lexi Hull, you can have some versatility you can tap into. And I think Caitlin Clark is ready this year. I've said it once, I've said it twice, I'll say it three times. Active in transition, throwing the ball ahead, but I would like to take this drive. I'm comfortable in between if I have to be, but if I can get to the rim, I'm fine. And also, I can hit these threes. They've established the ability to have a flow between Caitlin and Kelsey Mitchell. That question is off the table. And Aaliyah Boston, as you said, has elevated her game. You can use her in so many different ways. So we take those three. We have pressure points. We feel comfortable about being able to defend on the other side of the floor. We're going to run. No matter what, we can now put you in a tough spot. So I think the Fever have set themselves up to, okay, last year didn't necessarily go how we wanted to. We gutted a series out against the Aces and realized, okay, if we can do that and do what we kind of did at the start of the season, what do we have? And I think that's what this roster is.
No, I think that's fair. I think to the concerns for me, it's general health. Get well soon, Monique Billings. Aaliyah Boston made her preseason debut a little bit later in the cycle. But I think for me, it's just kind of peeping the big depth for this group now. Because I think if Aaliyah goes down at any point, like it does start to thin out a little bit in terms of who you have in the front court. I am a fan of Monique Billings, but if you're Sadie Hurst or Myesha Hines-Allen 2-5, you do just get smaller and teams may feel like you could poke at things a different way. So keep an eye on the big depth for Indiana. And just some perimeter defense stuff, like the non-Raven Johnson perimeter defenders, what does it look like? I largely trust Lexi Hull, but like even that, I think based on the depth that the Fever have in the wing room in particular, I think there is just a level of shot making she's going to hit to where you can feel the full impact of that perimeter defense or the downsize. Sophie Cunningham, not afraid to defend anyone, but trust her more defending threes and fours than I do trust, you know, defending ones and twos. That bakes into how often the Fever want to actually get into the full court pressure defense that we saw a big uptick of last year. Like, I'm just keeping an eye on what that portion looks like and what kind of pressure that puts on the big room defensively. That's pretty much where I'm at with the Fever. Anything majorly, not maybe that majorly concerning, but what's something that you're keeping an eye on when it comes to the Fever on that front?
Defense. Just defense. All of this makes a lot of sense. All of this makes sense if they can defend at a certain level. It doesn't have to be A+. It just has to be enough to where, okay, we're not getting exploited. We get stops, we run, we are able to put pressure in the half court. I think that's where the Fever will rise. So that's where it gets tricky.
Okay. We move to the Phoenix Mercury, who I don't know if people are forgetting, but they were in the WNBA Finals last season. They still have Alyssa Thomas, who is just a mainstay in the MVP conversation. No Satu Sabli, who is a member of the New York Liberty now. But you still have Kalia Copper, who you were hoping to have a healthier campaign than she had last season. You still have two very good players and a lot of depth. So I think for me, with early intrigue, it is seeing the Alyssa Thomas experience again, who, again, I'll repeat, MVP caliber season last year. Lots of triple-doubles, as we know, but the way she's able to take things as a driver, more pick-and-rolls initiated by her this past season, and defensively, she remains an all-world defender on that front. So, like, she's going to set the tone on both ends of the floor. Excited about that. A more unleashed version of Kalia Copper, and I've said it on this podcast when we talked about the Mercury. The fact that Ka is hunting these threes and hunting these pull-up threes in particular is very intriguing to me. I think that unlocks a little bit more variety within the two player actions that she can get into with Alyssa Thomas and with their other bigs for that matter. And so, like, I'm excited to see these stars in this element, and people are doubting the Mercury again. And if you give this team even a hint of an opportunity to be petty or put a block on their shoulder, they're going to do so. And so I am just excited to see what another season of the Mercury being doubted looks like for them and how they're able to build on.
Well, I hate to tap the button again, but continuity, that's the Mercury's deal. That we established this base last year, like, and this is why they're in the contender tier. Satu's not there, but Alyssa Thomas still is. Sammy Wickham still is. DeWanna Bonner now has a full season. Like, they have talent, and they have an understanding of what they want to do, and you shouldn't forget that. On both ends, they have a feel for what they want to do offensively and defensively. And once again, they have hidden a lot of people in the preseason. So whatever you thought you saw in the preseason probably is not going to be what you saw in the regular season. They have movement. They have intention offensively. They have activity defensively. And so this is a team you're going to have to deal with over the course of the season because they have a very particular style of play. They have highly talented players, and that makes things very interesting. So if you're talking about a team that could easily – you wake up, you scroll social media, like, why is Phoenix the 2 seed right now after 2 weeks? Well, they know what they're doing. Alyssa Thomas is very good. You play through her. You got cutting. You got movement. You got spacing. Tough to deal with.
There you go. One thing I'll add, one person we didn't see in preseason play because of overseas obligation, Steve, did not see Monika Koamakani yet, Steve. That's someone I'm interested to watch play basketball again. Robbed from the all-rookie team. Raw from all defense last year. I want to see how she builds on that. And I think with a little bit more on-ball responsibility, let's see what these pull-ups look like. So I just want to sprinkle that in on the Phoenix Mercury front. As far as concerns, you do not have Satu Sabli at this point. And so for me, looking at the perimeter room, aside from Kalia Copper, what does the creation look like? Because as much as Alyssa Thomas and in general the big room is going to do in terms of the hub work, the handoffs, and things like that, there are just going to be some moments. There are going to be some teams that are willing to switch against the Phoenix Mercury. And they saw an uptick of switching as the season went on last year. And the Aces certainly tapped into a bunch of switching as the final series went on. Aside from Ka, who in that guard slash wing room is going to be comfortable attacking and winning enough of those matchups? They do not need to become an all-star to be, you know, the third next to Ka and AT. But you have to have players that can win enough to kind of keep the machine rolling. So that's probably my primary concern with the Phoenix Mercury heading into the season. What say you?
I don't really have any concerns with the Mercury.
Okay. I like it. They are a very good team.
There are two other teams that are interesting as far as contenders go. And I think it's the Minnesota Lynx, where they deserve the salute for what they've built. You did lose quite literally 6 or 7 players out of your rotation. And you do not have the benefit of Nafisa Collier to start this season. And so it's going to be very fascinating to see what do they do at the start of this to jumpstart and put themselves in a position to, okay, can we establish something? Can we establish something within our starting lineup that is our starting lineup right now? Can we get back to these principles? I think they have the roster where they kind of have enough of the playmaking, the skill set. We can put pressure on you. Do you have enough of the defense? Like, there's just not as many automatic levers for the Lynx. And, like, Olivia Miles, I think, is going to be really good. But, okay, can you find consistency for 40 minutes a night? That's where it gets interesting for the Lynx at the start. Now, if they're able to answer enough of those questions, and now Nafisa Collier comes back, we're talking about a different story. So they very much intrigue you as being able to knock on the door and be like, well, we learned a lot about ourselves. We have our best player back now. You have to deal with her in a different degree. Not going to be fun for you. So I think of the top four or five teams, all of them will probably qualify for a hot start. Someone could surprise. The Lynx, I think, is more just, can we do enough to just keep our feet on the ground and see what happens? The other team that I feel like fits in that category for me is also the Los Angeles Sparks. And so I think being able to have this lineup, and I know everyone's like, why do you want to win now? Why would you try and win now? Who doesn't like winning? Like, did you guys not? Like, winning is like you play to win the game is literally the thing. So
not her, Kelsey Plum.
Kelsey Plum being activated as a ball handler. Nneka Ngumike being able to unlock different lineups. The activity of Ray Burrell. De'Erica Hamby's return. I think there's a lot of things the Sparks could establish as far as, like, if I was to say there's one team that, oh, how did they do this at the start? I would probably circle the Sparks. And it's like, like they need a sprint to start the season, but, like, if they have a hot start and they hover in a higher range than they should do, like, people thought about the Mercury last year. I think people thought about the Dream 2 years ago. Like, this is the team that could easily just shake things up because we have a lot of players that are pretty good and we want to win right now. So throwing it out there. Maybe they're not your contender, but think about it.
No, I think that's fair. I will say, I guess to hang on the Sparks for now, like, I'm excited just to see what this new core is going to look like. Again, you are well within your right to disagree with them accelerating the timeline with the Kelsey Plum trade. Ultimately, the Ariel Atkins trade, you bring Nneka Ngumike in. So I understand why Sparks fans would be a little bit antsy about, okay, wait, this is a little quick. Are we actually ready to compete with, like, Vegas, New York, et cetera, et cetera? Understand that. As far as what they have actually put together, like, this does feel like a pretty balanced group with a lot of high-end talent. And so, like, if you are able to hit enough of the defensive notes, Ariel Atkins has been fantastic on and off the ball, particularly off the ball, defensively during preseason play. Easy to see how she's going to slide in. You get De'Erica Hamby working at the level. You have Nneka Ngumike working at the level. And then you slide in and say, okay, here's Cam Brink. Now we can go a little bit more conservative with our coverages, but now we got this run protection. You go from one of the worst defenses in the league to, like, at minimum, like, middle of the pack. That enough probably puts the Sparks into the playoffs. And from there, Kelsey Plum could be a pressure point. Nneka Ngumike could be a pressure point. And you just have a lot of fun, a lot of different variations that you can get to from a lineup perspective. So high variance for the Sparks group if they're able to stay healthy, but there is a pretty high ceiling with this group. And then circling back to the Minnesota Lynx really quickly. I want to say they are, you know, not fair to say they are the Las Vegas Aces, but there are some very key differences between the two. But we are fresh off a year where the Aces were around 500 and then found it in the second half of the year and then were able to game plan and ultimately win. I don't think it is far-fetched for not just for the Lynx to hold serve. I think they can beat 2, 3, or 4 games over 500 by the time Pete comes back. Like, Courtney Williams plus Kayla McBride is a very talented backcourt that you can use in a multitude of ways, on ball and off ball, to give you some level of a base. They have good screeners in the front court. You also have Olivia Miles, whether she starts and this becomes like a kind of 3-guard alignment between those three, or Olivia Miles comes off the bench and you can just kind of cycle into those looks. There is a level of consistent creation that they can tap into from the guard room that I think is going to be helpful, can help them keep things going. Courtney Williams with her pull-ups can beat switches. Olivia Miles with her drives can beat switches. You ramp up the coverages against either one of those two, they're good enough playmakers to make that work. Kayla McBride can fly around, and against switches, she can also boogie with pull-ups and things. It's like you have that there. Emma Jacoba, I'm ready to see more of. She is incredibly good. And so, like, if you're talking about concerns, like, there is just a talent drain from the big man room when you don't have Fee for the first month and a half of the season. Atlanta Smith, Jessica Shepherd, elsewhere. Emma Jakova is going to be in rookie of the year conversations, or at the very least, she's going to be in all rookie conversations. I will just go ahead and stamp that. She's going to be, I think she's going to be there. And so if you get that kind of production from her, in addition to Natasha Howard, be at the level defensively, offensive rebound force, be a pick and roll finisher force, Nia Coffey, screen your tail off, knock down these spot up threes, defend different positions in the front court. There is just a roadmap for the Lynx carving out regular season wins. I just want to say people should not be surprised if the Lynx are just good. And then we get to July or August. It's like, oh, snap. Fee is here. This is now the proverbial team that nobody wants to play in the playoffs. I'm excited to see what this Lynx group is going to look like. And again, I'm with you, Steve. Like, this Sparks group can be very, very good. And so those are the seven we wanted to hit on today. We hit on the others on Friday. More about the Sky, the Dallas Wings. Ooh, boy, the Wings in preseason play. They've been fantastic. Any other teams you want to talk, or any other things you want to shout out here before we get out of here, Steve?
No.
Okay. Your time is up. My time is now. You will not be able to see us because we are now heading out of here. Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel for all the playoff coverage that you need. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main channel for all the W analysis that you need. Follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. Follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.